For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Ministry uniformity and diversity in the local church. This is where I live. I live in the tension between these two things as a church leader. Definitionally, I'm using the term ministry uniformity to refer to ministry roles that the New Testament says clearly that all Christians should play. And this is not an exhaustive list or an exhaustive set of scriptures, but certainly sharing our faith is an area of ministry uniformity. Helping one another grow to maturity in the faith is another one. Loving one another is the great mandate that Jesus gave to all of his followers. And then the one another imperatives in the New Testament letters unpack that, what it means to love one another in various ways. Financial stewardship to advance God's work is clearly an area of ministry uniformity. We're all to become, with God's help, better stewards of His financial resources. Corporate prayer is an area of ministry uniformity. It's the will of God for all believers to gather together with other believers regularly to pray out loud and to intercede for people and for the advancement of God's kingdom. You could add hospitality. There's probably a number of other things you probably could add here. That's what I mean by ministry uniformity. By ministry diversity, I mean what the New Testament speaks of as areas of ministry strengths or ministry roles that are unique to individual Christians. These are roles that not everyone necessarily has to play, that some are given strengths that others don't have. We could talk about personality as an area of God-given diversity. We could talk about natural talent as an area of God-given diversity. We could talk about acquired skills as an area of God-given diversity. But the main area of ministry diversity that the New Testament emphasizes is diversity of spiritual gifts. We have, as many of you know, four main passages that teach on spiritual gifts in the church. Romans 12, 3 through 8, where Paul, after urging all Christians to give our whole life to God and urging all Christians to be transformed by the renewing of their minds, commands all Christians as one of the keys to having a renewed mind to begin to think about ourselves sanely. He says, namely, in terms of how we're gifted differently to play as with our teammates to serve God. 1 Corinthians 12 through 14 is the longest passage on spiritual gifts, written to correct some of the abuses that the Corinthian church was involved in here, and emphasizing, insisting that whatever else spiritual gifts are, they are avenues through which we are to love and serve one another. Ephesians 4, speaking of the church broadly, says that the reason that God gave apostles, prophets, evangelists, and pastor teachers is to equip the church to do the work of ministry. And in that setting, he speaks of spiritual gifts as one of the main ways that the church does its work of ministry. It's interesting that this in Romans 12, and as indeed almost all but one passage in Paul's letters that talk about body life, when he uses that metaphor, he's using it almost exclusively referring to the diverse gifts that we have, like body parts or body organs, rather than as a metaphor for loving one another, although gifts are agents of love. 1 Peter 4, Peter emphasizes that all of us are stewards of God's manifold grace. We've been each given gifts to steward to the glory of God and in the power of God. I'm pretty confident that the list of gifts that are given in the New Testament are not exhaustive, that they're representative of the kind of diverse gifts that God gives to His people. Furthermore, with several of these gifts, we don't even necessarily know what they are because nothing is said. For example, the word of knowledge. What is the word of knowledge? Is it God's special ability to recall knowledge from Scripture? Is it God's special ability to know perhaps what someone is thinking? We don't know, and we really can't know because we don't have any more information on that gift. So the point is there's tremendous diversity here. Peter divides the spiritual gifts up into two categories, word gifts, speaking gifts, and serving gifts, as in not so much speaking as in practical service. Paul's list in Romans 12 seems to fit nicely into one of those two categories. It's not clear where the so-called charismatic gifts would fit in the word and service categorization. Robert Clinton, in a book that I'll refer to more in just a moment, suggests that these gifts can be clumped in three categories: word gifts, gifts that communicate God's truth; love gifts, by which he means gifts that express the love of God through mercy, service, etc., and power gifts, which is where he puts the so-called charismatic gifts. Lee Campbell in our church has suggested that another way to look at these diverse gifts is that some are special enablements to build the church in, not in terms of being tribalistic or ingrown, but to build body life, to improve the quality of community within a church. Other gifts are more outward, and that they're especially have to do with drawing other people into the church of Christ. And yet, again, other gifts are more upward. They're more prayer gifts, faith gifts that are more overtly vertical, and that each of these sets of gifts, when they're operating properly, act like cheerleaders to help everyone become more well-rounded, or certainly the group more well-rounded. Another area of biblical ministry diversity would be what I would call ministry field passion, that God does, not always, but it seems as though God often calls believers to specific fields of ministry. Think, for example, of urban youth or addicts, or some people have a decades-long passion for certain unreached people groups. Paul certainly said that God gave him a special ministry calling to the Gentiles, etc. All right, so I think it's not very controversial, the fact that the New Testament teaches both ministry uniformity and diversity. But in practice, we see a lot of differences here, perhaps from church to church or even within a given church. Here's just a little simple diagnostic tool to think about your church or your small group with regard to this. If the vertical axis means that more and more people are involved in areas of ministry uniformity, whereas the horizontal axis means that more and more people in the group are involved in legitimate, different ministries according to their strengths, you would have four quadrants. Whoa, I would call the lower left-hand quadrant the dead church, where you have hardly anyone involved in ministry, whether it's the stuff we should all do or our unique roles. This is the unfortunate consequence of a clergy-laity view of the local church, which dominated for so long. And you wind up with what Ray Stedman said many years ago, a church which is like a football game where there are 22 people on the field desperately in need of rest and 22,000 in the stands desperately in need of activity. That is bad. Very bad. The ideal, of course, would be in the upper right-hand quadrant. It's always the ideal where you have a home church or a local church where most of the people are involved in loving each other and in serving in evangelism, discipleship, etc., and that in that context there's an appreciation and a help for people to find their own unique gifts or strengths and to mobilize them. That's the ideal. Then you, that would be like, if you want to use the wall metaphor, that would be like a stone wall where you, they're all those rocks are stacked up against with each other. They're forming, they're serving a common purpose to be a wall, but they're all different. And the stonemason, think of church leadership as stonemasonry. The stonemason is placing the rocks where they fit. Or if you think about team sports as another illustration, to think about a basketball team, a good basketball team, everyone on that team is sound in the fundamentals, blocking out and rebounding, defending, dribbling, passing, shooting. They're sound in all the fundamentals, but the coach has deployed them to play positions where they have special strengths. That's a good basketball team. And they're all teammates, willing to play, wanting to play together because the overriding goal is for the team to win. Now, more commonly, what we find is one of these last two situations. The one would be a case in which a church is highly mobilized in diverse ministries. People understand that they have different gifts. People are excited about discovering and using their gifts, but there's a kind of a fragmenting effect of a group like that, that there's not enough understanding or emphasis to also be willing to do the same things in the area of uniformity. So this is part of what builds good community, when everyone's committed to the fundamentals. So think about the basketball analogy. This would be like a team where every player is fixated on what they're best at, and they're all trying to be their own unique stars at what they do, keeping their own stats rather than subordinating themselves to the team goals as a whole. Or, if you use the wall analogy, it would be just a random pile of stones. And there's a fragmentation in churches like this. I think churches that emphasize, for example, really emphasize gift tests and getting the first step, getting everyone involved in a ministry according to what their gifts are, often winds up like this, that people are busy, but they do not have true community, and they're, by definition, they're not well-rounded as Christian workers. The opposite situation, oh, by the way, here are some symptoms of that situation that I've seen in such and those sorts of groups. Members rarely talk about the one another's, rarely talk about personal discipleship. That's not on people's radar. There's often no quality context where people can come together regularly and practice the things that we're all supposed to do. The overall mission or vision for the whole church or the whole group is fuzzy. People don't really know what the group is trying to accomplish because they're focused on their own unique ministries. You often find in such churches workers competing for workers to their ministry. Well, we need more helpers for the addiction ministry. Well, that's really not what I feel suited to do. Well, we need you. And this, people become a rope and a tug of war for people's unique ministries. The Corinthians were guilty of a carnal comparison of each other according to their gifting. As you know, that, you know, the eye can't say to the hand, I have no need of you. People comparing and coming up with elite forms of gifts, which contradicts the whole idea that we've all been given our own unique gifts. Often in such churches, you will hear people copping out of serving in areas that they don't like, saying, well, I'm not gifted in that area. I don't witness. I don't share my faith because I'm not gifted in that area. That's for the gifted evangelist. Well, that represents a misunderstanding of ministry uniformity as well as diversity. Such groups often lack appreciation for the fruit of the Spirit, because the emphasis is overwhelmingly on what gifts do you have. And Paul seems to argue that the fruit of the Spirit is probably, on the whole, more important. Often in such groups, people don't appreciate the fact that God will put us deliberately into situations that we're not gifted in, as a way of challenging us to take a step of faith, and that such steps and such willingness to serve wherever we're needed is a key part of character transformation and growing faith in Him. So those are some of the symptoms of that lower right-hand quadrant. Now we turn to the opposite, the upper left-hand quadrant, in which there's a great appreciation and outworking of people being active in the uniform areas, but not enough of an appreciation for the need for diversity within that uniformity. To think of the basketball analogy, this would be like a team where the coach made everyone play every position an equal amount of time without taking into account what are their special strengths that we can leverage to win games. To use the wall metaphor, this would be like looking at everyone as bricks that are absolutely the same and interchangeable, building the brick wall. What would be some of the symptoms of a church or a group that is in this situation? One would be that many longtime workers, even leaders, have basically no idea where they're gifted. I've seen that in this church. I've seen longtime, godly, committed home church leaders 15 years into their Christian life having no idea what their distinctive strengths are. That in such a church there would be very little teaching on the biblical topic of spiritual gifts. This sort of church often is characterized by, what is that, gifts and ministry? Yeah, you just don't hear people talking with each other about where we might be gifted. It's kind of like not in the vocabulary of that culture. That would be a symptom that we're not really thinking about this. Developing a ministry, which all Christians should do in such a situation, would refer almost exclusively to just a few ministries like evangelism, discipleship, and teaching. Whereas the New Testament also speaks of developing a ministry in terms of the exercise, consistent, faithful exercise of your diverse gifts, 1 Corinthians 12. Often in such groups, there's a false dichotomy between the fruit of the Spirit and the gifts of the Spirit. In other words, not only saying that maybe character formation, like the fruit of the Spirit, may be more important than the gifts of the Spirit, but saying, I've heard it said, the fruit of the Spirit is what matters, not the gifts of the Spirit. Well, that's a statement more extreme than what the Bible says. Such situations often you see much awareness of the opposite dangers, a very developed critique of a church where everyone's doing their own unique thing and the abuses that come from what we've often called charismania, a very clear understanding of the opposite extreme, but not able to articulate what are the dangers on being on this other extreme that we're close. That's funny about how we do that in all kinds of areas. Have you ever noticed how we love to take the opposite extreme that we're not tempted to and use it as a way of justifying staying in an opposite extreme? That's just kind of a fallen MO. Unhealthy comparison happens here too. If everyone's doing the same thing, then fleshly competition often breaks out about who has the most disciples, who's won the most people, which is unhealthy comparison. Many people, what I've found, who are in a church or a situation in this upper left-hand quadrant, have a trouble in sustaining motivation over the long haul in their Christian lives, especially when church growth slows down. I think this is what I have seen in working with a lot of adults in our church. I can't prove this biblically, but I know that there is a having a growing understanding of where God's given you strengths and faithfully using those is very connected to motivation. And if you, to go the long haul, that's a part of what you need in order to stay highly motivated. It's not everything, but it's part of it. So there you have it. And so then afterwards you can buy my app about how to fix this problem, and we can all go home now. I want to say, to be crystal clear, these feel like contradictory emphases, but they are not. They are biblical emphases. And if we don't feel the tension of being faithful in the areas of uniformity and of progressing in areas of, if we don't feel that tension in our own individual lives, if we don't feel that tension in the group that we're a part of, then that does not mean we're super spiritual. We're probably not living in that biblical tension that God wants us to live in. I would also say that as we try to move toward God's ideal, which we'll never attain in this life, but we're supposed to press on toward that corporately, the answer is not to swing from extreme to extreme. You see this in individual Christians and in whole churches where they'll be all about, here's the four things that all of us need to do all the time. And then when problems occur or whatever, it's like, forget that. Here's the latest gift test. And you do that and that'll fix everything. I know a little bit about that because we've done some of that at one point in our church. And that's not God's way. I think God's way is we should be looking at the flock that we're a part of, whether we're in official leadership roles or not, and saying, where is it that we might be weak, and how can we emphasize the complementary strength? It's sort of like dribbling a soccer ball down the field. You're going this way and that way, but basically you're emphasizing this maybe more at this time because you realize we're way over here. You're emphasizing this more at another time because you realize we're over here. I think this is one of the key wisdom/judgment calls that leaders have to make. And that's the constructive way to do it. We may have to occasionally critique our own imbalance in this area, but it's more important to introduce emphasis where we lack. Okay, all I'm going to do for the rest of our time is talk about the lower right hand and the upper left hand situations, which I think most of us probably will find ourselves in to some degree. How can we move from either one of those toward more health and balance in this area in our churches? So let's talk about just some ways that we can influence our own church toward an increased appreciation and mobilization in the uniform areas, evangelism, discipleship, body life, financial stewardship, etc. The first and most important is always going to be to teach and to preach God's word about this area. We don't want our people to be sheep who are just responding to the latest fad that we throw in front of them. We want people to form biblical convictions about important areas of biblical teaching. And so we would want, that's what you would want to do. You'd want to have ideally an ongoing emphasis on these areas of ministry uniformity. If you are teaching through books of the New Testament, for instance, especially in the letters, these areas of uniformity come up a lot because they're emphasized by the authors. How many times do the New Testament letter authors emphasize reaching out to non-Christians? How many times do they emphasize building each other in love? How many times do they emphasize us helping each other intentionally to mature? They will come up of their own accord if we are faithful to teach them. At times, we may want to do a topical series from specific scriptures on one of these areas, like loving one another, or a topical series working on texts about evangelism because we judged that that's needed for more of our people to buy in this area. Always as we teach and preach about these uniform areas, we want to emphasize that this is not something that we're beating people to do so we can feel better about ourselves or whatever, but that these are ways of loving people that God has given us. It's all about being more effective in our love for people. If we love people, we will serve in these ways. And we want to continue to emphasize God's empowerment. God will give us the power to love our brothers and sisters when we don't really like them. God will give us the power as we open our mouth by faith to talk about Jesus, etc. We can also promote quality books on these areas of uniformity. And so I've just put up three, including one by me. I hope that doesn't sound pretentious. Books that really are focusing on one of these areas of uniform ministry, like evangelism, loving one another, personal disciple making, and to get those, promote those books so that they begin to get into the bloodstream of our church is a very powerful ministry in itself. We can form quality structures to facilitate the practice of these uniform ministries. That's why we're convinced here that home churches, whatever you want to call them, small groups, home churches, are so vitally important, not just because the New Testament church met in homes, but because we see that when Christians meet regularly together to help each other mature and to reach out to lost people together, etc., that structure then becomes a very practically important way for people to learn the fundamentals of a ministry lifestyle. You need good wineskins or structures if you want to teach your people financial stewardship. It's not enough to beat on them to give their money. We need to devise ways where people can do that conveniently and being informed. We need prayer meetings. Charles Spurgeon said that he felt that all things considered, the leader needed to tend to the prayer meeting as the most important meeting that a church has. That's a logistical, structural area. Classes. Having special classes on how to be effective as an evangelist, a disciple maker, etc., would facilitate this. Having evangelistic events that will help our people to reach out and invite their non-Christian friends and neighbors to where they can be exposed to Christ and His church. These are pretty common sense measures, but often we neglect them. We need to be able to articulate and creatively repeat the overall mission of our group, or people by default will tend to become fuzzy and what's this all about, or go off and do their own thing. In our church, most people would say that this is the mission, that our home church wants to multiply, either by breaking into two or by collaborating with another home church or three other home churches to form a new home church. And we want to do that by all working together to share Christ with people and to help people grow in maturity after they come to Christ, and to do that not in isolation, but to do that in the context of real loving community. Sometimes we just say in Xenos, E plus D in C. Evangelism and discipleship in the context of community. A clear mission is going to help people connect the dots as to why it's important for all of us to be serving as workers in these uniform areas. When it comes to leadership roles in the church, like an eldership or being a deacon or being a small group leader, it's, I think, not only practically helpful, but it's wise to hold out for people to really be involved as a lifestyle in these areas of uniformity in order to be considered for leadership. We don't make people leaders just because they're greatly gifted in an area. We look also to their character, and we look to them being good, fundamentally sound players, so to speak. People who do the rebounding the defense. I'm using that metaphor again, as faithful servants. We should esteem members who are faithful in this area, this ministry uniformity areas, even if they're not leaders. Yes, we should publicly recognize new leaders and draw attention to how they are faithful in these areas. But I think, like, for example, within a home church, I'm a big believer in good gossip. We all think of gossip as negative, and most gossip is. But good gossip is powerful. I love to talk to someone else in our home church about a third person who's growing and who's a good example. I love for them to hear that I was gossiping about them in that way. And that's part of how we model for people the importance of something like this area. So those are some of the ways that we can influence our group, lead it toward a more health in the area of ministry uniformity. Now let's talk about the opposite situation where we want to influence our group or our church toward more health in the area of ministry diversity. Again, so here's what John Stott says pertaining to this in his commentary on Ephesians. He says, so Christ's immediate purpose, he's referring to Ephesians 4, his immediate purpose in the giving of pastors and teachers to his church is through their ministry of the word to equip all his people for their varied ministry. And the ultimate purpose of this is to build up his body, the church. For clearly, one way that the whole body grows is for all of its members to use their God-given gifts. That needs to be a biblical conviction on our part. These gifts are so beneficial, both to those who exercise their ministry faithfully and to those who receive it, that the church becomes, he's a little optimistic here, steadily more healthy and more mature. It's a little bit more difficult than that. But who am I to contradict Stott, who was a pastor as well as a teacher? Yeah, that's the point. That's the burden here in this area. Or as Dwight Smith says with his co-author, Martin Robinson, one key task of leaders in the church is to model and to create a culture in which everyone naturally expects to find their gift and use it. Mobilization takes place most effectively when people are using the gifts that God has given them. Members become mobilized when their internal motivations are recognized and used. This is a key element in personal transformation. I think he's right about that. Personal motivation is intimately connected to the gifts that God has placed within them. So, with that mindset then, what are some steps we could take in this direction? Obviously, just as in the previous situation, we want to teach and preach faithfully on this doctrine in the course of our teaching ministry in our church. We can highlight these passages as we teach our way through books. And you may or may not know that besides the four main passages about gifts that I mentioned, there are a few dozen additional passages that speak specifically of spiritual gifts in the book of Acts and in the letters. So we can draw attention to these as we come across them. We can give topical series in our group rooted in Scripture. And I think one of the best ways to do this is to do a series on community where half of it's about the one another's and the other half is about gifts. This way we're bringing the uniformity and the diversity in a local church together the way God intends it. We can emphasize, we should emphasize all along that gifts are not about me. That's one of the problems. Emphasis on spiritual gifts in America has a bad name for two reasons. One, because of charismatic excess. and two, because it's been hijacked by a self-absorbed culture into I need to find my gifts so that I can feel good about myself and I can do what pleases me. Again, the reason why God wants us to know where He's gifted us is so that we can serve others and glorify Him more effectively. And we can never emphasize that enough. And we need to constantly emphasize that God is so wise. He knows exactly which gifts or combinations of gifts that would be best for each and every one of us. Constantly preach against comparing ourselves to other people in this area as the height of folly. God knew what He was doing. I have exactly the strengths that He wanted me to have. And our group has the strengths that it needs to accomplish His mission. Your faith will be tested on that, personally and corporately. We can promote quality books on this area. I don't think there's nearly as many quality, in my opinion, quality books about ministry diversity as there are about ministry uniformity. These are the three that I have found especially helpful. The one on the right, Body Life by Ray Stedman, was written 50 years ago almost. But he has some very balanced teaching about ministry uniformity and diversity in that book. It's very readable. Smith and Robinson's book, Invading Secular Space, is provocative in the way that they interact with ministry uniformity and diversity, and I think they do a good job. I think the best book on this subject, content-wise, is the one on the left, Robert Clinton's Unlocking Your Giftedness. It's more a set of lecture notes that have been cobbled together. But I think that it is more biblical, it's more comprehensive, it's more practically helpful if you're willing to take the time to sift through this material than any other book that I've found on this subject. We can urge leaders. Hopefully we have leadership teams. We can urge leaders, like home group leaders, for example, small group leaders. We can urge them to use the gifts that they know they have in their leadership roles. Isn't it fascinating that twice Paul has to remind Timothy, don't forget to use that gift that God's given you. He was in a leadership role, dispatched to Ephesus. We don't know what his gift was, it doesn't matter, but for whatever reason, the responsibilities of leadership were tempting him to not use the gift, specific gift that he'd been given. And Paul says, don't do that! That's going to hurt your leadership. I have seen that through the years, that there's a lot to do when you're a leader. And I was talking to a brother the other day who realized that he had been so taken up with legitimate responsibilities in helping to lead his home church that he was teaching hardly at all, and he's a gifted teacher. And I got to say to him, don't do that. And he told me afterwards that as he began to deliberately teach more, not only could he see that that was having a good impact on the group, but it infused him with more overall energy to do what he needs to do as a leader. So by definition, when you use your gift or gifts as you lead, you're blessing, God can bless the church in a special way through the use of your gift, whatever it is. This is going to increase your confidence overall to lead and to do other things that you may not be as good at, because there's a subjective thing here that it infuses more confidence into your soul. When leadership teams encourage each other to use their gifts in their leadership, as well as doing all the fundamental things, then this models for our church the kind of interdependence that God has in mind for the whole church. And it also helps non-leaders to realize, oh, I don't have to be a gifted teacher to be a leader. This person's gifted in mercy, and they hardly ever teach. But I see them and respect them as a leader. I could lead. We can encourage members to prayerfully seek an understanding of where they are gifted. Now, what I have seen through the years, again, are the two extremes. I came to Christ in the Jesus movement where like this was job one. Everyone had to stop everything and couldn't do anything until they found out where they were gifted. And that has a paralyzing effect on people. And then we often swing from that to don't worry about that. Just don't worry about that. You be faithful in the areas of ministry uniformity, and God will make that clear in his timing. That's an extreme also. And people will say, you know, it takes decades typically for you to know where God's gifted you. Not necessarily. I feel like in my case, God, and I'm not the only one, God showed me pretty early on where he had gifted me, and that was a big motivator to get more sanctified. That was a big motivator on my part to learn to be a well-rounded Christian worker. It worked just the opposite of what we're afraid, the effect that it will have on us. Paul says in Romans 12:3, again, after he says everyone, uniformity, should give their whole life to Christ. After he says everyone should be transformed by God through the renewing of their minds. That's a uniformity issue. He says this, I say to every one of you not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, or in the Greek, to think sanely versus insanely. What does he mean by that? That I am, he's commanding me to have a sober assessment of who I am. Notice how he immediately unpacks that. For just as we have many members in one body and all the members don't have the same function, so we who are many are one body in Christ and individually members of one another. So since we have gifts that differ according to the grace of God that's been given to us, let us exercise them importantly or accordingly. As Clinton says in his book on this passage, true dedication to God involves a search of God's will for my life, which also involves service for him in terms of a proper evaluation of one's gifts and exercising those gifts interdependently with others. You see what I mean? It's not the most streamlined sentence there. But he's right. Paul is saying, if you want to be transformed by God, by the renewing of your mind, you need to change the way you look at yourself. And part of the way you need to soberly assess yourself with God's help and others is how has he gifted you to serve him? Just going to throw these out. There's no passage in the Bible that tells you how to discover your spiritual gifts. I'm not a big fan of gift tests because they seem to me to be a very Western, highly individualistic tool. But as you look at these passages about spiritual gifts, you find some of these themes cropping up, that since gifts are given to enable us to serve, having a servant lifestyle is going to be pretty important in finding out where you're gifted most of the time. Since gifts are given primarily to build up brothers and sisters in fellowship, your being involved truly in Christian fellowship is part of the context that you need to place yourself in if you want to find out where you're gifted. Perhaps the most reliable indicator of gifting is when you're in fellowship serving your brothers and sisters and you begin to get a pattern of feedback from other brothers and sisters about the strength that you have. That's probably the most reliable indicator of gifting. Gifts often have as part of what they are an ongoing itch. That is to say that they're, Clinton calls this the gift drift syndrome, that we will tend to gravitate towards certain areas of ministry. It's not that we don't want to be a good fundamental player, but we find ourselves in an unusual way, drawn toward showing mercy or drawn toward explaining the word to people or whatever. What are the internal gravitational pull within your own soul? Gifts often come with their own set of eyes. That is to say that one of the ways that we function is that when we're gifted in a certain area, we tend to be able to assess the flock through that set of eyes. So when my wife and I, for example, who help along with others to lead our home church, when we talk about what does our home church need, we usually see very different things. What I see most often is ignorance that needs to be educated. What my wife sees more often is people with difficult personal issues that need to be walked through those things. What are we doing? We're seeing our group through the eyes of our giftedness. And that's often an indicator of gifting. If you're gifted in a certain area, you will often be drawn in a good way toward other people who are similarly gifted. God often providentially places into your life another older believer who's gifted in a similar way. And you will often feel yourself drawn toward them because you sense we have similar strengths and I want to get next to that person and learn more intensively from them. That happened certainly in my early Christian life. Paul says in Romans 12, he calls areas of giftedness a measure of faith, that we should regard ourselves soberly as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. And as you read that passage, it's clear that that's a synonym for gifted area, that you have a measure of faith. In other words, with a gift usually comes a capacity to believe that God will work through you regularly in that area. Doesn't mean that that area won't be tested. I mean, I get a lot of testing of my faith in a teaching ministry. But it means that we find it easier to believe God can work through me in this way in a consistent basis than we may feel in other areas. That doesn't exempt us from service in other areas. Also, since Paul calls gifts empowerings, it makes sense that an indicator of where you're gifted is that you actually experience the power of God working through you consistently in that area of ministry. Not always, but relatively speaking, you sense God's power is working through me as I serve in this way. So there is no app. There is no test. There are biblical principles that we're to prayerfully consider as we keep presenting ourselves before God, saying, I want to be as effective for you as possible, and I know that this is part of it. We can make gift identification and development an important discipleship goal. In Xenos, we talk about how when we're discipling a younger Christian, or when we are discipling each other as peers, we want to get together regularly and we want to do four things during that time. We want to pray to God together for each other and others. We want to study the Word or a quality Christian book. We want to help counsel each other toward increasing maturity, and we want to coach each other into a more and more effective servant lifestyle. Well, this would be one of the key, not the only, but an important area in the coaching part of discipleship. Early on, we should be praying for the Lord to give us insight, if that's His will, to see where the particular area of ministry strengths this person may have. Walt Hendrickson, who wrote one of the standard books for disciple making, says, as we train young Christians to become disciples, one of our primary objectives should be to help them discover and develop their gifts, since every believer has gifts which God holds him accountable for developing and using for the sake of the body. In making disciples, we're not trying to produce proficient technicians who are able to reproduce themselves by a prescribed methodology. That would be the cookie cutter, excessive uniformity. Rather, we're trying to develop men and women who are disciples, diligently exercising their particular gifts and abilities. Therefore, Hendrickson says, it's imperative that early in the discipling process, the man, this is a earlier book, the Christian, begin to look for his gifts and develop them. Whatever else the training of a disciple should include, helping him to discover and develop his gifts must be a part of it. I think that is a very practical, powerful way to move toward health, healthy diversity. We can urge members to take personal responsibility to steward their gifts. Peter says this is a stewardship. These are resources that God gave you to manage. A lot of times I hear Christians complaining as though it's someone else's primary responsibility for them to exercise their gifts. No, it's your primary responsibility. God entrusted these strengths to you for you to use faithfully. And that is the most important linkage. Others may help. We will need the help, in fact, but this is between me and God. Clinton says, understanding our giftedness is a major step forward toward our ministry flowing out of our unique being. Giftedness is not the only factor that contributes to our attaining God's focus for us, but it's a very important one. And when all is said and done and you're standing before God at the Bema seat, what kind of accounting do you want to give concerning the abilities and skills and gifts that God released to you? That's a steward's perspective. We can urge, I gave you the other handout by my colleague, Ryan Weingartner, gives a lot of really practical ways that we can begin to use our gifts in like a home church or small group setting. And I think that's a good place for us all to begin. Not that he won't use us beyond our home church or small group. And we also, as leaders especially, we can create quality structures that facilitate people using their gifts and pursuing ministry passions we may have. I find in our own home church that we have a lot of people who are gifted in service. And service ministry is often largely reactive when needs come up. But to the extent that we can give people who are gifted in that area a vision for the importance of what they're doing and help them be consistently looking for needs to meet, that would be a good thing. We may create special ministry teams that are focused on specific fields of ministry, like, again, people who are recovering from addiction, people who are at the end of life or whatever. These teams, when properly led, can serve as a way for people who have that passion to make a big impact in addition to their other ministry in their home church or small group or whatever. Where we can link people up who are gifted similarly, especially an older Christian with a younger Christian, that can be dynamite. It was very helpful for me. And we can develop classes to equip people in areas of special giftedness, a class for gifted teachers, a class for gifted mercy, people who give mercy, etc., to the extent that we're able. We should esteem members who faithfully use their gifts to serve God. And especially, Paul lays upon the burden of us with more public gifting the responsibility to esteem gifted people whose gifts are less public. This is the idea, in my opinion, of the unseemly member. In context, he's talking about the physical body. They have parts of your body that are not very seemly. Right, but you take good care of those parts because you know that they're important. You may not feature some of those parts, but you take good care of them because they're so important. In the same way, he says, those of us who are gifted in seemly ways have a special responsibility to esteem those who are gifted in ways that are not so public, so that the church as a whole learns that their role is vitally important, and similarly gifted people see that. And that's about all I got. Not much. Which area Where would you diagnose your small group or your church? Where would it roughly be in this quadrant? How can you move? What's one or two steps that you could take individually or as a leader or an influencer to help your group move toward the ideal? That should be more than enough for us to think about.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.